Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Nope, not today. But the Dow keeps flirting with 20,000. So if it gets there, does it matter? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, December 28th. Good to have you with us. What's 170 points worth? I'm talking about points on the Dow Jones Industrial Average. 170 would put it above the 20,000 mark for the first time. We don't know when or if that will happen, but we've already come pretty darn close. So would the Dow at 20,000 be cause for celebration? Marketplace's Mark Garrison gives us a reality check.
Look, it's not like Marketplace is against fun. Those Dow 20,000 hats exchange floor traders are already wearing, great. The Berserko graphics that'll explode onto CNBC screens, love them. But if you're looking at the Dow in search of a big picture view, stop. Just stop. It's only telling you about 30 big American companies. We often say the market is not the economy. The Dow, it isn't even the whole market. USAA portfolio manager Bob Landry explains what's missing.
Small company stocks, international stocks, things like commodities and other alternative assets.
The Dow headline number alone also doesn't explain just how uneven the stock market rise is. Bank and energy stocks are doing great after Trump's victory. Tech stocks, not so much. And of course, the Dow doesn't tell us about the bond market, which is vitally important. All that being said, there is short-term impact associated with Dow record-breaking. Brad Barber is a finance professor at UC Davis.
When the Dow is hitting a record high, we know that there tends to be somewhat more selling activity than buying activity in the market in aggregate.
And that kind of selling means the market often pulls back soon after hitting a milestone. Excitement-driven trading can mess up financial plans, not to mention generate additional fees and taxes. If you've got a sound retirement investment strategy in place, certified financial planner Mary Beth Storjahan has simple advice for when the Dow hits 20,000.
You do nothing. You stay the course. You rebalance every 6 to 12 months to make sure that allocation is still in line with your needs, and you do nothing else.
So when that day comes that we do the numbers and the Dow's over 20K, don't read too much into it. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
If you've been on a plane in the past couple months, you've probably heard a flight attendant warning people about the Samsung Galaxy Note 7 and the potential risk of it bursting into flames. After a massive recall earlier this year, it's now a federal crime to bring the Note 7 onto a plane. For people who still haven't returned their phones, some cell phone carriers are taking matters into their own hands. T-Mobile just released an update that will essentially kill the phones. AT&T and Sprint aren't far behind. Marketplace's Rhea McCrace explains.
Alfonso Macias is still holding on to his Samsung Galaxy Note 7. His friends ask him if he has a fire extinguisher next to his bed, you know, in case the phone catches on fire.
No, not really. I wouldn't give it up because the way the phone is, the way you can do more things in it.
He's such a fan, he's willing to take the risk. Him and about 175,000 other people who refuse to give them up.
Our customers who like Samsung phones tend to love Samsung phones.
Kelly Crummie is a spokesperson for Verizon. She says the phone is a safety hazard, so carriers are helping Samsung forcibly separate people from their phones by sending out a powerful update.
That will eventually render the phone unusable because it drains the battery.
I don't recall anybody, any phone manufacturer ever doing anything quite like this before.
Jan Dawson is an analyst with Jackdaw Research. He says Samsung doesn't want to be at risk for any more costs. Also,
the longer this whole thing lingers on, too, the longer the PR bad news for Samsung lingers on as well. And so they just want to finally put an end to all of this.
The debacle has already turned into somewhat of a running joke. In the video game Grand Theft Auto, you can use the smartphone as a weapon. It'll take time, but Samsung will rebound, says Darcy LeCouvre, editor-in-chief of the industry blog Android Authority. And he says its latest move to remotely kill its phones reveals just how mighty the company really is.
People think that their devices are wholly theirs, right? This just goes to show everyone that there still is a backdoor hidden in all these phones.
He says in the coming days, many people may be surprised to wake up with a device that's worthless. I'm Rima Crace for Marketplace.
On Wall Street Today, you just heard we didn't get there. Details when we do the numbers. What we're doing on the show this week is looking ahead to the new year. Three big events that will shape the global economy in 2017 took place in the voting booth, and not just here in the U.S. I'm also talking about the Brexit vote in the U.K. and the no vote in the Italian referendum. Marketplace's European Bureau Chief Stephen Beard joins me now for a sense of what we can expect in the year to come. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Lizzie.
When we look out into 2017 in Europe, it is a significantly different landscape than it was in 2016. Set the stage for us.
Yes, it certainly is. I mean, they're talking about 2016 as the year of revolution, and they're not only talking about Mr. Trump's victory in that context. We had two big electoral upsets here in Europe, which it is suggested part of a pattern.
Well, when we talk about sort of these two different things, right? David Cameron ends up stepping down in the UK, Matteo Renzi in Italy. Are they part of this larger pattern when we think about the new year?
Well, the Brits were voting to leave the European Union, whereas the Italians were voting on a package of constitutional measures. But the effect is likely to be the same. And the effect of the Italian vote could be to trigger a general election in Italy next year, which could bring a Eurosceptic anti-Euro party to power. So these two votes taken together do constitute a terrific blow to the EU, and they undermine the bloc's fundamental drive towards unity, towards bringing the fractious tribes of Europe closer together.
You know, we talk about the Brexit, and I was there a week after the vote, but that was 6 months ago. Where are we now? Are they any closer to actually, you know, leaving the Union?
Marginally. The Prime Minister, Theresa May, says she wants to start the exit negotiations before the end of March, and that could mean then that the UK is out by 2019. But Prime Minister May's biggest problem by far lies on the other side of the negotiating table, Britain's European partners, represented by the formidable and forbidding figure of Frenchman Michel Barnier, who's made it very clear that he wants to punish Britain for having the temerity to vote to leave the EU.
Being a member of the European Union comes with rights and benefits. Third countries can never have the same rights and benefits. Cherry picking is not an option.
Barnier has actually gone even further than that and warned the UK that it could actually face an exit penalty. It could be forced to pay as much as $60 billion as an exit fee just to get out. That didn't go down very well with the Brits.
Before we even get to the negotiation, what sort of consequences have we seen, are we already seeing in the UK? Certainly the pound has taken a hit.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, almost immediately after the result, the pound fell between 10 and 15% against the dollar. That's pushing up import prices. Inflation has ticked up. But for now, the big American, Japanese and other foreign banks based here in London, are worried that after Brexit, they're going to lose untrammeled access to the other 27 member states. And as a result of that, other countries elsewhere in the EU have been actively trying to persuade some of these businesses to move away, to relocate to their territories. London, it seems certain, will lose some business as a result of Brexit.
Where does all of this leave us when we think about 2017? Is there a chance things calm down or do they get more fraught?
France, Germany, the Netherlands, possibly Italy too, All will have general elections next year, and anti-euro parties are set to do pretty well in some of them, and in some cases they might actually win power. So it does look as if the EU is in for a further pummeling in 2017. But if 2016 has taught us anything, it's that anything can happen.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Belt states right now, farmers are worried about something that sounds like it came out of the Little Shop of Horrors, a super weed. Palmer amaranth is its name. It's tall and tough, chainsaw tough. The weed has been a problem in the South for a couple decades, but now it's showing up in states like Iowa and Minnesota, threatening corn and soybean crops. And some farmers who were trying to do a good thing by planting native grasses and flowers may have unwittingly spread it. Marketplace's Annie Baxter reports.
As a weed scientist at the University of Minnesota, Jeff Gonsolis has seen a lot of mean weeds. But the Palmer amaranth is notoriously aggressive.
It's very adaptable, and it's a threat because of how quickly it can spread.
He says the superweed can grow 2 to 3 inches a day, up to 8 feet, crowding out other plants. It easily produces upwards of 250,000 seeds per plant, and its woody stem can be murder on combines cutter bars.
You may not even be able to harvest your crop.
Experts think the weed may be getting spread as farmers restore prairies, planting pollinator-friendly species on lands they put into government conservation programs.
The pollinators and butterflies just love those flowering plants.
Bob Hartzler is an extension weed scientist at Iowa State University. He says the government pays farmers a premium for establishing pollinator habitats on conservation lands. And with corn and soybean prices down, farmers are more interested in doing that. But Hartzler says local seed dealers lack enough native seeds to meet demand, so they buy species from out of state and throw them into the seed mixes.
And they went to areas that had Palmer amaranth.
Hartzler suspects contamination from out-of-state seeds helped spread the weed into 49 counties in Iowa, up from just 5 a few years ago. But Anthony Cordelet with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture cautions against blaming the superweed spread on conservation programs.
You know, it's on our borders, and it's going to continually keep moving in or trying to move in through all kinds of different avenues.
Whether it came in through seed mixes or by hitching a ride on farm equipment, he says it was bound to arrive one way or another. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Coming up,
the before and after is like a big difference.
Which is a good thing, because you don't want bricks just falling off buildings. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 111 points, 0.5%, to close at 19,833. The NASDAQ shed 48 points, 0.9%, to finish at 5438. And the S&P 500 slipped 18 points, 0.8%, and at 2249. We mentioned Samsung's trying to kill those Galaxy Note 7 phones, essentially making them useless. And carriers are helping. Samsung dialed up about 0.5%. Apple disconnected 0.4%. Verizon off 0.3%. Sprint up 0.3%. News out today, the pending home sales fell to a 10-month low in November. The realtor Remax Holdings closed down 0.7%. The online real estate database Zillow lost 1.5%. In Europe, Britain's FTSE rose 0.5%. France's CAC 40 and Germany's DAX were unchanged. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.51%. You're listening to Marketplace.
We may not know what next year is going to bring, but your listener support of Marketplace guarantees we'll all be better informed and better prepared. Make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at Marketplace.org by December 31st.
This is Marketplace. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. How familiar are you with the concept of sustainable investing? That's the idea that when making long-term investments, people and companies should consider environmental and social responsibility, but also that they should think about risks, like, say, a warming climate and what that could do to a business. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Jed Kim reports.
To advocates, any growth in sustainable investing is a mixed blessing. Mindy Luber is CEO of Ceres, which works with large companies to integrate sustainable practices. She says more is better, but
in the end, we don't want this to be a separate niche.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
Meaning environmental investment, it ought to be part of the fundamentals of making investment decisions. Now, that said,
we're not there yet. Big pension funds, endowments, and foundations are showing signs of movement, though, says Elizabeth Lewis with the World Resources Institute.
$1 in $5 invested in the United States is invested with some sort of sustainability screen. It's grown almost 400%. Since 2007.
Lewis is the lead author of a new study that looks at the state of sustainable investing. It finds there are obstacles to getting more investors committed to the idea. Things like too much focus on short-term gains and not enough investment funds available for those that do want to invest. But she says that's also an opportunity.
It's an unusual situation where the demand is huge and the supply just is not keeping up with it.
This comes as the incoming Trump administration has signaled support for the fossil fuel industry. Lewis says, though, that sustainable investors' long-term focus extends beyond the next few years. And in fact,
the election result has actually made some of them indicate that they are going to step up because they believe that this is frankly one thing that they could do is to invest their money into the right types of companies.
She says it helps that there's growing evidence you don't sacrifice returns putting money into sustainable investments rather than broad market benchmarks. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Earlier in the show, we brought you a big picture look at the European economy and what to expect in 2017. But what about here at home? Obviously, the economy was a big issue in the presidential campaign, and one central part of that, jobs. How many we have, what we need, how they pay. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman joins me from our desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting. Hi, Mitchell. Thanks for coming on.
Good to be here, Lizzie.
So the president-elect, Donald Trump, is going to take office in a pretty good economic place. One of the longest economic and employment recoveries on record. We have job growth averaging around 175,000 jobs a month, give or take. Unemployment, 4.6%. So, on balance, good for Trump, bad for Trump. Things are in a pretty decent place. Where does he go from here?
Well, you know, that's right. We already have what economists call full employment or very nearly full employment. And so it could be very hard to drive unemployment lower, you know, than about the low 4%. What that means is that it actually could be a very hard economy to make better in 4 years. There is one big variable here, and that's economic stimulus coming from the federal government. You know, after the initial stimulus under President Obama, Republicans in Congress blocked big spending on infrastructure, you know, public works jobs. Donald Trump has promised just that, plus big corporate and individual tax cuts. Now, the idea there is to generate more consumer and business spending, which means also more job growth, which could spark wage and price inflation. But Douglas Holtz Aiken, who's at the American Action Forum and ran the Council of Economic Advisers in the George H.W. Bush administration, actually sees a lot of room to run still for this economy.
Ultimately, you'll get the competition for labor driving up wages. The key is that if these investments make those workers more productive, you can drive up the wages without any threat of having to drive up prices as well, and you're paying people more in real terms to work. And that's really what you'd like, better take-home pay and more productivity.
One question, Mitchell, is about how the president-elect, I guess, engages with data on the campaign trail. He would use economic stats about employment and other things that did not come from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, question the validity of those. So do we have a sense of whether President Trump is going to act like candidate Trump in that respect?
Well, you know, we don't know. Now, during the campaign, both he and his son said that unemployment was much, much higher than the Bureau of Labor Statistics reports every month, and alleged that there was political motivation maybe in the current Bureau of Labor Statistics. If he revives this, you know, it really could undermine economic confidence. It could confuse business decision makers. I guess it could rattle markets. Here's Betsy Stevenson. She's now a professor at the University of Michigan, and she was the chief economist at the Labor Department during the first Obama administration.
Our statistics have not been politicized, right? They are not political people. They are nerdy statistical people who are just trying to measure things in a way that's consistent over time, in a way that's consistent with what other countries are doing.
When we look at economic data, the one place a lot of economists have looked at is at wages. They haven't really budged, except for a tiny blip last year. They've been more or less stagnant for the recovery, really, for decades. So what is the prospect of higher wages starting to come for workers, maybe under this new administration?
Well, you know, you see in the economic philosophy of Donald Trump and his nominees that they believe that simply driving economic growth, helping businesses to get around regulation and just be able to do business better will in itself both drive job growth and drive wages up. The new Secretary of Labor, he's certain to simply reverse a bunch of Obama executive orders on higher minimum wage and more pay equity for federal contractors. There are rules that were passed to be more friendly to union organizing. And then, you know, there are appointments to things like the National Labor Relations Board, which, again, are likely to make it more difficult for union organizing and thus to push wages higher in those sectors.
From the Marketplace Desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, that's our Mitchell Hartman. Mitchell, thank you.
You're welcome.
Turn to a slightly different story about jobs, from the macro level to the micro. In New York City, a group of young people is learning a trade that's so important it literally holds the city together. WNYC's Ilya Meritz has this story about the craft of restoring masonry.
Meet Dakota Green. He's 22 years old and wears a hard hat. A lot of people call him Slim.
Everybody thinks I'm skinny.
Fashion used to be what he wanted to do for work. But lately, Green has been commuting more than an hour from Brooklyn to the Bronx to spend his days learning to restore a grand old mausoleum that's seen better days.
This hasn't been repaired in over 100 years.
The craft Green has been learning as an intern at Woodlawn Cemetery is masonry restoration, how to rejoin blocks of marble and granite with fresh mortar he mixes himself.
As you can see, the mortar and everything was removed from here. Look how deep down that goes. That's pretty damaging.
You get your whole finger down.
Yeah, if the whole foundation from under here were to fall, this would just collapse.
In New York and in cities like Chicago and Pittsburgh, there are laws requiring regular inspections and repairs for large buildings to stop stone and brick from coming loose and killing people. so masonry restorers are always in demand. A fully qualified journeyman can make $50 an hour. The 16 interns here are all high school grads. Most knew nothing about stonework before they started, but Jonte Stanley says she's developed an appreciation for crypts and gravestones.
We're doing their families justice for the monuments that they left behind, you know what I'm saying?
She points to the Borden Mausoleum, honoring a family that got rich off textiles back in the 19th century. Picture elevated sarcophagi and huge ornamental urns.
The before and after is like a big difference. We really brought this thing back to life.
What did it look like before?
It was a lot of like bio growth on it and like carbon staining, like black stripes and things like that.
Clearly, Stanley got the lingo. Her teacher, Rob Capiello, everyone calls him Cappy, says the interns learned things in just 9 weeks that will keep them employed for years to come.
Well, they got all their basic qualifications, OSHA training, suspended scaffold, stationary scaffold. So they got a lot of certifications, but they have an edge up on a lot of people just getting into the trade.
Recently, Capiello handed his interns diplomas and gave out hugs.
Dakota Green.
Jonte Stanley is one of just two women in the program, and she's staying at the cemetery for a while. She's now an apprentice here. She's 22 and a mom and says this is her future. Sure beats the other jobs she's had, retail gigs at Staples, Panera Bread, and Yogurtland.
I was going to be unhappy just doing stuff for money, and I just figured that if I try something different and I get to work with my hands and be out in this beautiful outdoors every day, it's just a win-win situation.
She gets money and skills, and the crumbling angels and tarnished obelisks that guard this cemetery get some love and attention. In the Bronx, I'm Ilya Meritz for Marketplace.
This final note before we go, you don't need me to remind you that 2016 has taken a lot of beloved celebrities, among them Muhammad Ali, Prince, David Bowie, and just yesterday, Carrie Fisher. So people on the internet have responded in a very 2016 way, by creating a GoFundMe page with the stated goal to protect Betty White from 2016. Demetrios Risikos of Spartanburg, South Carolina wrote, "If she's okay with it, I will fly to wherever Betty White is and keep her safe till January 1st. As of showtime, the page had raised more than $3,500. And if White doesn't feel the need to be protected, the money will go to the Spartanburg Little Theater. All right, that's it for us today. Today, the Dow fell 111 points, 0.5%. The NASDAQ shed 48 points, 0.9%. And the S&P 500 slipped 18 points, 0.8%. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the program for us. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. We'll see you all tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.